So can you tell me about the object that I'm holding?
I got a vision of something that is, it's a little bit on the heavy side. It's like it's a kind of a metal, it's round. That's the vision I got of it as soon as you talked about it.
The principal aspect of this is round. If you were going to draw it, what would you draw?
Let's see. I would draw something. It's kind of like the back end of it would be as kind of a circle. It's like it fits kind of just in your fingers very good, and it's a little bit on the heavy side. That's what I got from it.
Tell me about the round part.
It is kind of coppery bronze in color. The light bounces off of it. It's kind of a little shiny, but it's kind of like brushed. It's some kind of metal or something.
Well, the handle is coppery, but the round part is glass.
Ah.
What I have is a large, heavy magnifying glass attached to a sort of bronzy-looking plastic handle.
Oh wow! Look at that. Okay, well that's somewhat correct. Yeah, I thought it was a smaller object, something you like almost holds in your fingertips or something like that. But that's often. But okay, interesting. All right, welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Russell Targ about his book, The Reality of ESP, A Physicist's Proof of Psychic Abilities. Very interesting. We're having an interesting conversation here about the history, of course, that Russell had with the SRI and the authorities, their interest in this, and there's many different avenues we can take. I wanted to ask you, Russell, about, I guess, the results of a remote viewer, because usually, as far as I'm concerned, they always draw the result on a white piece of paper. But just because you sketch it, of a place or an event or something like that, it doesn't mean that it's easy to actually decipher what you're looking at. So how did you guys approach that? I mean, if you get a bunch of lines or something, what do you begin to interpret at that point? What is it? Where is it? Or how does that work? Looking at maps or other photographs, or how do you do it?
Well, we know that drawing is a non-analytic ability, so it's very hard for a person to say, I see the object, and this is what it is. In fact, a viewer in our experiment will almost never give a correct name of what the object is. See, naming is a arbitrary exercise that we give. That is, Buddhists would say that we give everything we experience all the meaning it has. That is, the things that we experience in general don't have meanings. If I have an object in my hand, you can describe that as an object that's round and has a handle, and that's what it is. But as soon as you give that a name, it could have been a frying pan, it could have been a magnifying glass, could have been a hand drill, could be any number of things. But if a viewer is able to make a sketch of what he or she is experiencing and not name it, that's often what the answer is. So we urge people to make a sketch of what they're experiencing. It's not a artistic contest. It's just a desire on our part to help people get from out of their consciousness onto a piece of paper what it is. Our assumption is that as soon as I ask you to do something, you agree that you will try and do it, then you have found the address of my object, and I will then assist you, even though I don't know what the answer is in general, I will assist you and encourage you to make a little sketch of the surprising thing that shows up in your awareness. And that's a non-analytic ability, whereas if you're trying to name it, that's analytical, and psychic functioning is simply doesn't work that way. I don't have a good reason that you might say, well, why is psychic functioning non-analytical instead of analytical? I would say, well, our perception is non-analytical. That is, we give things names, but they don't actually have names. the Buddhists annoyingly say that the world is empty, and people hate that because they, it seems like there are tables and chairs and things in the world. It doesn't look empty. What they mean is that it's empty of meaning. Does we give everything we see all the meaning it has.
Yep.
So, and this is all understood in the 8th century. Padmasambhava described all of what I'm telling you. So this is not New Age. This was understood 1,200 years ago and written down. So it's the idea that in drawing things, you're able to concretize the images that appear in your awareness. In general, you don't know what the thing is, but you have a picture. And that's because the thing that you see does not actually have a name. The sophisticated idea. Things don't have names. We give them names. Somebody in Sweden, they would have a different name.
That's right.
So if I could just get you to describe and draw the thing that appears in your awareness, then you're able to contact the object. And people are able to do that quite well, even though they're not artistically inclined. If you make a simple drawing of the thing that comes into your awareness, that will be the answer. And people become more skillful at separating the psychic signal from the mental noise. The mental noise comprises naming and memory and imagination and analysis. Those are all sources of mental noise. Whereas I'm asking you to quiet your mind and simply describe your experience. One of the things we know, for example, is that in the early days of ESP research in the 1930s, J.B. Ryan at Duke University was doing his famous card-guessing experiments, where he would ask students to tell him, am I looking at a one of five cards, a circle, a square, cross, wavy lines, or something else, circle, square, star, cross, or wavy lines. Mm. Which of those am I looking at? And some people were very good at that. They could do shockingly more correct than you would expect. But unfortunately, as weeks go on, people would lose that ability and they would decline to chance results. Statisticians would call that going toward the mean, and the ESP would disappear. Now, the very fine results that they had in the beginning wouldn't be nullified, but it would be very disappointing that one of the most reliable things that Ryan saw was the decline effect, the extinguishing of ESP in the laboratory. Mm. And that for two reasons. One is that they were bored into a decline because the experiment he was doing was inherently very boring. The other is the mental noise, that is, if you know what the five objects are, then they appear with great clarity. So an example would be, if I tell you that I'm thinking of a number from 1 to 10, can you tell me my number? Well, you might start by saying, well, Targ wouldn't pick 1 or 10 since he just named those two, and he probably wouldn't pick 7 because 7 is everyone's favorite number. And that process is not ESP, that's analysis.
Right.
And that's the enemy of psychic abilities. And we never did anything like that. We always had people describe interesting outdoor targets or unusual objects that we would hide for them. And in 23 years of work at Stanford, we never saw a decline. Our people got better. Hmm. For example, if I said, I am visualizing an interesting place that I know pretty well somewhere in the world, and you have probably not seen this for certain reasons. Can you describe the location that I'm visualizing? You would have no problem doing that. I would say, just make a little sketch of the surprising outdoor site that I'm visual. Just draw something. And then I would try and mash up your drawing with five possible places. That's very easy to do, and people can do that excellently, and that's what we did for 2 decades. And even though the experiment with the location, you have to find one location out of an infinitude of possible places, that's much easier to do than guessing my number from 1 to 10.
I see.
And one of the things we learned at Stanford, that is one of our accomplishments is to move away from the forced choice guessing game. That's why guessing playing cards is very, very difficult. We all are very experienced. We can visualize the five of diamonds perfectly clearly. You can see that with no noise at all, perfectly clear picture. So that when you're trying to guess playing cards, you start out with a very clear image of 51 incorrect cards. Whereas if I tell you there's something in the world that you have not seen, you start out with a blank screen, and you're able to allow the correct image to materialize in your awareness.
Hmm.
Interesting?
Yeah.
And people can learn to do that. We call that separating the psychic signal from the mental noise.
And that's
a learnable skill.
So meditation, et cetera, does that aid in that process as well, quieting your mind?
We have found that the people in our program who were meditators did better than the people who weren't meditators. But there are certainly people... But I guess my answer to your question is yes. If you have found a way to quiet your mind, you will do better at remote viewing than otherwise. I can tell you in the earlier on, we were talking about the ESP teaching machine program we did for NASA. Can people improve their skills at discerning which one of four squares is going to light up? In that program, the meditators did much better than the non-meditators.
Yeah.
So that would be an example where I can say, yes, we did a formal experiment, and almost all of our good results came from the meditators.
Yeah, interesting. Now, Russell, there are so many different... examples and cases, quote unquote, maybe we could call them that we can talk about. I do, however, before we go to some of those, wanted to ask you a little bit about the Stargate program and Project Scan 8 and all these. There are some interesting articles online, and I think that these are some of the examples of both Pat Price, Joe McMonagle, and Ingo Swann has been involved in, and that is, some of the more, quote unquote, strange or bizarre fringe cases of remote viewing UFOs, distant planets, underground bases, all kinds of interesting things. What can you say about this and some of the more kind of extraordinary remote viewing sessions that you've know about?
Well, in the first chapter of Reality of ESP, I talk about the early experiments we did with Ingo Swann before there was a program. When NASA came to talk to us, NASA wanted to know, could Ingo tell them anything about Jupiter before the forthcoming Pioneer spacecraft got there? And Swann sat down quietly, closed his eyes, and said, well, as I drift into the rich area of Jupiter, I see that there's a ring of ice crystals around it. And it looks almost like the ring around Saturn, but it's much more tenuous and ethereal. But I can see the ring of ice crystals all the way around the planet. It's very beautiful. And no one had ever heard about ring around Jupiter before Ingo Swann described that.
Hmm.
So there'd be a case where on demand, Swann was able to quiet his mind and describe something hundreds of thousands of miles away that no one knew about at all. And I show the drawings that he made and his transcript, and then I show a photograph from NASA, from the Pioneer, which greatly corresponds to what he drew. So it shows that your remote viewing is not limited to planet Earth, as you can see into the far distance as well as into the future.
Now, were you ever involved in some of the more fringe, like UFO remote viewing and stuff like that?
I was not. From time to time, our viewers would talk about UFOs, but as scientists, we were interested in what they were saying, but since that's inherently not verifiable, that didn't seem like a fruitful area to go. For example, if Pat Price says, I think that there's a UFO base under Mount Shasta, well, that's very interesting, but we're not going to launch an expedition to dig up Mount Shasta and try and find it. So here the rich inner life comprising UFOs and other things, but we can't do anything about it.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting aspect. There are some other things in your book that's very fascinating as well. We have everything.
It's like Alice in Wonderland. I'm only, as a scientist, I'm only interested in one impossible thing at a time.
Right. Russell, tell us about strangulation from a distance, healing from a distance, those kinds of things.
Well, it's a natural outgrowth that is, the idea that we can describe somebody's physical body from a distance would be a natural outgrowth of what we're talking about. If you can know anything that is, there's no limits to what you can know, you can describe the physical situation of a distant person's body and do intuitive diagnosis. And indeed, I describe some of our experiments and some of my experiences with intuitive diagnosis. And there are two books written on that subject where I know the authors very well. Mona Lisa Schultz has written a book called Awakening Intuition, and Judith Orlov has a book called Second Sight. And both these women are physicians, psychiatrists, and are medical intuitives. And one of the things that I found is that in workshops that I do, one of the easiest things to do is to describe the physical state of a distant person. So this intuitive diagnosis is quite easy to do. There's also a distant mental influence where the thoughts of a person can affect the physical body, the physiology of a distant person. And William Broad has done lots and lots of experiments dealing with that. And he has a book called Distant Mental Influence. And what he showed in quite a number of formal experiments is that a person in the laboratory, often himself, could change the heart rate or skin resistance of a distant person. So on a random schedule, Broad would be shown the image of a person sitting in a TV studio, and when he saw the person's image, he would try to excite the person or calm them down. And during the other periods, he would just sit quietly. And in many, many experiments, he and his partner, Marilyn Schlitz, were very, very successful at changing the heart rate or skin resistance of a distant person. And that whole genre of experiments, distant mental influence, has been widely replicated. So the idea that the thoughts of one person can affect the physiology of a distant person, that experiment is very well established. Now, when the Russians went to do that, they did a long-distance experiment between Moscow and Leningrad. And in Moscow, they had a very experienced person who could do telepathy. And in Leningrad, they had his stage partner. Both of these people were psychologists, but they had established very great rapport in mind-to-mind communication. And this is all related to me by my friend Larissa Valenskaya, who was there and saw this experiment. She was in the Leningrad side of it. So when the person in Moscow was said, can you send an image to your friend in Leningrad? He thought to himself, well, I really want to get to his attention, so I will just visualize my strangling him. This is in Russia, 1970. So the Russians are much more interested in outflowing psychic ability and affecting people at a distance than we were at SRI. We didn't strangle anyone at SRI. We were interested in inflowing psychic information. And Nikolaev was able to quiet his mind, visualize strangling his friend, and his friend's heart rate began to change, and he began to breathe hard and, in fact, fell off the stool that he was sitting on. They had to terminate the experiment because they were afraid he was going to die. So this is all I described as much as I described here, the way Larissa told me about it. It's also described in Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain. So the Russians were very interested during the whole Cold War in using psychic abilities to affect American dignitaries and policymakers when they would appear on television. They wanted to know, can we change the behavior or the health of an American leader when they appear on television? Huh. So the Russians wanted to know, can we outflow our psychic awareness to affect somebody? Now, during the we consider remote viewing quite easy to do, because I will have a workshop with 30 or 40 people, and I expect more than half my people to do pretty well, because I'm charging them to attend my workshop and bring me to wherever they are. So I expect everybody will either, what I tell them is that not everybody will become a great psychic, but I expect everybody to either do something psychic or see something psychic from your neighbor. So I consider psychic ability a natural ability that people can learn to do swiftly. And that was our experience at SRI for two decades. Soviet Union, now we published our findings in the Proceedings of the IEEE, the Institute of Electrical Engineers, and we published them in Nature magazine in England in the 1970s, and this was quickly translated into Russian. Our friend Larissa, who was living in Russia at the time, did the translation, so we know it was translated, and the Soviets were trying to replicate our work in the intelligence community, and they were not successful.
Okay.
It's very hard to make somebody be psychic if you think they're going to be punished if they get it wrong. Now, in the middle 1980s, I was done with the secret program, and I went to Russia as a guest of the Soviet Academy of Science, and we went to Yerevan in Soviet in the Armenian SSR, in the southern part of the USSR, Soviet Armenia, city of Yerevan, where they have a university. And at the university, one of the psychology professors had replicated our remote viewing, and it looked exactly like our remote viewing. People made the same kind of pictures. They could see into the distance. They could see into the future. And it looked just like what we had done at SRI. But in Moscow, the Soviet intelligence people were not so successful. So that as we get to see now what they had done during the Cold War, it's very hard to be psychic in a dictatorship.
Well, that's a funny statement, actually. The Soviets were involved in this kind of work, though, as you say, and there were some pioneers there, like Vasiliev in the early days. But basically, would you say, though, that the Cold War, if you will, kind of expanded into the psychic realm? Can we put it that way?
Well, it was probably the Cold War that stimulated the CIA to support our research. We knew the Russians were doing it, and we didn't go to the National Institutes of Health for our research because they knew we knew they would turn us down. We went to the CIA and to NASA because they're more courageous, and we could provide them with information that they couldn't get otherwise. For example, we had a demonstration of ability task. I went to the head of intelligence for the CIA, and he said, your data looks very interesting. If you can describe one of the sites that we're concerned about as a national security issue, if you can give me good information about that place, we'll support your work. So a week later, a CIA agent came to our laboratory in California with the geographical coordinates of something, and I went to the little shielded room with the psychic policeman, Pat Price, and said, here's the target on a slip of paper, here's the coordinates, latitude and longitude, what do you see? And Price said, well, this looks like some sort of research and development facility. As I psychically lie on top of a building, I see a giant crane, A-shaped gantry crane, rolling back and forth over my body. It's a huge crane. It's got 8 wheels, 4 on either side of the building, and it's shaped like a letter A. The giant crane, let me draw that. So he then drew the crane. And we then went down to the vault underneath our building where the CIA agent was waiting for us. And we said, well, this is what we got. This is the biggest thing at the site. And he said, well, that's very interesting. And he then unrolled a large aerial photograph of the facility at Semipalatinsk. And right in the middle of it was this giant gantry crane situated on top of a building. It did have 8 wheels, 4 on either side. And the CIA guy said, well, it looks like you're looking at the correct place. Your drawing looks just like my drawing. And we show both of those drawings. Those used to be top secret drawings, and we now show them in our book.
Right.
So you can see what Price drew and what the crane looked like. So he said, well, that's very interesting. Can you tell me what they're doing inside that building? So we went back into our shielded room, which is like a telephone booth covered with copper wire. And Price said, I see what they're doing in this building. They're trying to fabricate a really big steel sphere. The sphere is about 60 feet in diameter. And they're trying to weld it together through using orange peel slices, like gores, kind of gores used in dressmaking to build up a curvy skirt. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to weld these orange pieces together to make a giant sphere, and they're having a problem because the sphere is so thick that everything is warping. And that's what Price described. And unfortunately, he died 2 years after that. And a year after his death, the Russians took down the side of the building and rolled this big sphere out onto the plane so that our satellite photography could take a picture of the 60-foot sphere welded together just as Price described.
Huh.
And in fact, the Aviation Week article says that it's fabricated from gores exactly as Price described 3 years earlier.
So in other words, it can be a long delay before you actually get a confirmation of one of the sessions, in other words.
That's right. So in this case, we can say for sure Price did not get the information from the feedback because he had already passed away.
Right, yeah. Hmm.
But this was a kind of the fact that we could describe the gantry crane so accurately is the reason the CIA gave us a chance to go ahead, because we gave them such a very accurate description.
Indeed. What does life after death and reincarnation and things like that, how does that connect into this?
Well, that all pertains to the fact that we live in a non-local space-time, that we live in a universe that has a real part, which is what we normally experience, comprising automobiles and drinking glasses and things that we see. And there's also a complex part that allows things to be in contact with one another where you don't normally see them in connection with one another. It's a way of describing what physicists call non-local space-time. So the evidence for survival of death is really quite good. The evidence that even after people are dead, pass from ordinary existence, some aspects of their personality does survive. And they're a decade of, a century of very careful experiments, starting with the beginning of the Society for Psychical Research in England. Their principal interest was in determining whether the things that mediums saw in the 1880s in England were really true. And they did a lot of very careful experiments, and they decided that from time to time, a medium would communicate with a deceased person, and that person would provide information which was unknown to any living person. Like, the medium would tell you where the will was hidden or where the documents could be found. In one case, F.W. Myers had an agent of his talking to a medium, the so-called anonymous sittings, and his man, I don't call him his slave, his man would say, we're looking for the deceased person on this piece of paper. I don't know him, but Myers wants to know. So, and the medium then talked to this deceased person, and the person had a number of things to say. Medium could reminisce about an adventure that the deceased had with Myers, and said, by the way, I had a walking stick with a blade in it, a sort of sword. I had a sword cane that Myers always fancied, and I don't need it anymore that I have no body now. He should go to my mother's house, and Myers can take the cane out. My mother will give it to him. It's in the closet. And that all came to pass. So reading Myers' data is like looking for a long-distance phone call from the dead, often very accurate.
Interesting.
So the evidence, so I'm quite convinced that that in some cases the personality of a deceased person does survive. Where non-locality comes to fore is we say, well, where is that personality?
Yeah.
And because the personality, that deceased entity, is outside of space and time, and it's very hard to say where that person was. There was recently a chess game played between a deceased grandmaster named Géza Merezi, a Hungarian master who died in 1950, and through a medium, Merezi played with a Russian grandmaster, Viktor Korchnoi. And that game went on for several years. Halfway through the game, Korchnoi was uncertain whether he would win, because Merezi played a very, very complicated match in which very few pieces are taken. It just becomes, that's the way he always played. In the end, the living person won, but it was a very hard-fought game. And I gave the final score, the list of moves, to my brother-in-law, Bobby Fischer, the world chess champion. And Fischer said, this looks to him like grandmaster play, because anybody who can go 60 moves with Korchnoi is playing at grandmaster level. So that's one of the instances where I was from firsthand information that things that are produced through interactions with the dead are really paranormal in themselves. This was done before desktop computers played chess at a strong level. So I'm quite convinced that something does survive.
Indeed, that seems to be the case. We've talked with other people about it, and there's Definitely something going on there, for sure. Now, I wanted to ask you about the 10th chapter in your book, titled How It All Works, The Physics of Miracles, because you do have an interesting section there. I mean, you have an interest in theosophy, and you have an interesting chapter or part there on so-called occult chemistry. This is actually from the Theosophical Monthly magazine Lucifer, that was published back in 1895. Tell us about what occult chemistry is, Russell.
Well, there were two great psychics working with the Theosophical Society in the late 1800s, Charles Leadbeater and Annie Besant. And I'm just trying to think about when the periodic table was just developed by Mendeleev. And Annie Besant, who was really quite an intellectually gifted person, had the idea that maybe she and her buddy Leadbeater could look at these elements and see what they look like if you could describe them psychically. So if you have 92 elements to look at, they say, well, why don't we start in the beginning? So they looked at hydrogen. They got a big block of paraffin wax, the chemical formula for paraffin is C25H50. So this is loaded with hydrogen. And they looked at hydrogen, at the paraffin psychically, and they saw that they saw two different things. They saw, first of all, that the hydrogen atom, the proton, looked to be composed of three little centers of energy connected with one another. And they drew those. In fact, what they showed is that a hydrogen atom or molecule has two of these little triangular structures, each made of three balls of energy, which looks a lot like what we call quarks today.
Yeah.
In fact, I photographed the drawing that Charles Leadbeater made and then put that next to a contemporaneous drawing of a proton made of quarks, and they looked like they were drawn by the same person. So, however they did that, I photographed that out of the 1895 journal. So, however they did that in 1895, it looks exactly like what physicists are drawing today to represent what a hydrogen atom looks like. So I thought that was quite striking. They also said that there are really three different kinds of hydrogen, with different numbers of protons in them. They call them hydrogen, occultium, and Edgarium, because they're working in the city of Edgar. And those correspond to hydrogen, deuterium, and tritium, which we have today. And they were talking about isotopes of hydrogen before anybody had ever heard of isotopes. Nobody ever had the idea that you could have three different kinds of isotopes with different numbers of particles in them. So they were psychically way ahead. That is, isotopes weren't developed, the tritium wasn't found until 1932. So these two prodigious psychics in the 1890s were way ahead of modern physics.
How do you think that they extracted, if you will, then, this knowledge?
I think that they did what we've been describing during this hour. They would sit down in front of their block of wax and close their eyes and visualize with the intention of describing what does the fundamental atom look like, and they would just then draw. I mean, obviously the answer, she would then quiet her mind and draw what came into her awareness.
Yeah.
And she and Leadbeater were both very experienced, prodigiously successful psychics. And what it shows is that we have evidence that a psychic can see things the size of atoms, or Ingo Swann can see things the size of Jupiter and the rings around Jupiter hundreds of thousands of miles away, probably millions of miles away. So what we say is that we live in a non-local space-time, and there is no limit on what you're able to do. So the whole idea that I'm putting forward my book, The Reality of ESP, is that psychic ability is unlimited in space and time, and you can learn to quiet your mind and move your awareness into these distant realms that's available.
It's very interesting. What do you think? Do you think mankind would benefit a whole lot if we had more people doing this kind of work? I mean, we're constantly looking for answers, for solutions to problems. Is this an area, in other words, that actually could yield some new answers and some results, if you will, Russell?
Well, I think the answers, I think that it is beneficial to mankind because people will get a more spacious view of who they are. That as people get direct experience of their spacious awareness, their timeless awareness, then they will move away from the rather constricted view that they're just a little person trying to get applause and get money and get the things that the material universe has to offer, and that their awareness really has contact with the whole non-local space-time that's available, then they will have a much more spacious view of who they are and greatly diminish their suffering and their concentration on their own ego and move into these spacious realms. The Buddhists were interested in psychic awareness and meditation and moving into naked awareness or timeless awareness, not to do ESP, but as a way of communicating to the practitioners that there is much more going on in the universe. Indeed, each of us is much more than you understand by looking in the mirror. And by giving people this larger picture of their own humanity, it's very broadening and gives people a more spacious view of their awareness. I encourage people to do that.
Indeed, very good, Russell. Now, we've had people from the Monroe Institute with us talking about this, and there's a lot of correlations, of course, but is this any similarity between remote viewing and out-of-body experiences?
Well, there's a continuum in remote viewing from what we did in the laboratory. There's the remote viewing we did in the laboratory, as I've been saying, people quiet their mind and describe the surprising images that appear in your awareness. Nobody ever had a bad experience doing that. In an out-of-body experience, you're doing remote viewing, but bringing with you your emotionality, sensitivity, sexuality, whatever you're comfortable with, bringing that to the distant scene, distant location, and under those circumstances, you can have a much more involving experience, and indeed a frightening experience sometimes, as you get more involved with your emotionality, with what's happening in a distant place. And we didn't want to do that. We didn't want anybody in our lab, some naive person who came into our lab, we didn't want them to ever say, Targ separated my consciousness from my body and I can't get myself back together, that would be the end of our program. Because neither my colleague nor I are psychologists and are able to deal with disconnected, disintegrated person who's complaining to the management that we damaged them. Now, in working with some of our more experienced people, one of our viewers, Hella Hammett, I would often sit in our little remote viewing room, and as she would describe something, I would psychically go there with her and turn on the lights and open the door. We once visited Brezhnev's office in the Kremlin, and she described walking down the hall, and she saw a large red door covered with red leather held in place by upholstery tacks, and that's all she got. And I said, well, why don't I push open the door, and then we can go into the office. And we did that for an hour. We went to the office, we went down the stairs, we looked around the computer room. So we had a whole little adventure in Brezhnev's office in the Kremlin, which I later verified when I went to Russia. But that was a much more engaging situation, and we were aware of a kind of overriding danger that as we're wandering around the stairway leading down from Brezhnev's office into the floor underneath the basement of the Kremlin, we felt that that was a dangerous situation and we're not altogether comfortable doing that. So I would not do that with a naive experimenter, a naive viewer, because you could have a frightening experience.
Yeah.
So that the continuum from remote viewing to out-of-body experience. Now, as you know, Aleister Crowley wrote extensively about sex on the astral plane, and Ingo Swann wrote a book called Psychic Sexuality.
Yes.
So for the intrepid researcher, there's a whole additional world outside publications in the engineering society that's available to a remote viewer.
Indeed, Russell, because I'm glad you brought that up as well, because in that same paragraph, if you will, as you talk about psychic sexuality as from Ingo Swann, there is also this kind of interesting aspect of ethics involved in everything of this as well, meaning should one be able to always from a distance look wherever they want to, or is there, should there be an ethics applied to remote viewing? I mean, it could be considered obviously not only rude to pry into something, or especially looking at someone who hasn't given permission.
Well, if you're thinking about having a sexual encounter with somebody, that's best done between friends. Otherwise, it can be a kind of psychic rape.
Right. Yes.
So I think that ethics certainly apply in that regard.
But that there's no way that could be no. Let's actually. Well, that's interesting then.
Best done between consenting adults.
Right. But let's look at it from the other point of view. Is there a way to actually protect oneself from remote viewing, to block off people from looking at oneself or something?
Well, I think it's pretty hard to protect. I mean, if you're walking down the street, it's pretty hard to prevent somebody looking at you.
Oh, no, sure. But if one is at home, I guess, and doesn't want to be.
I think that the D.N. Fortune in the 1930s wrote a book called Psychic Self-Defense, in which she's concerned with protecting yourself from psychic intrusion. And she says, basically, you should concentrate on having yourself in good physical shape. So give up your meditation, quit burning incense, go out and run around, eat well, get physically strong, go bowling. So in a certain sense, you can say playing tennis or going bowling is the best protection for a psychic attack.
Okay.
sort of pull your awareness into the physical realm rather than into the metaphysical realm.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
That's what Diane Fortune recommends.
Okay. Interesting. I also wanted to ask you a little bit about what you know, what currently SRI International is involved in. I read, interestingly, the other day that you know, SRI launched a spin-off company, Siri Incorporated, which is, of course, what Apple acquired in 2010 to kind of develop their technology for the new iPhones and everything else. It's kind of borderline artificial intelligence programming and stuff like that. Do you keep tabs on what SRI is producing and what they're doing still to this day?
No, they're about 3,500 people and generally have 1,000 programs going on. I could ask Siri what she thinks of ESP and see what she says.
Right. That'd be interesting.
What is ESP, Siri?
SPM at GM Electronics closed at $25.08 today, down 24 cents, or 0.96.
She did not understand what I was asking.
You got a stock quote there, right?
That's right.
Well, maybe there is something to that then, since you brought up that in the beginning. Yeah, the silver trade, right? So
can't tell you what was on her mind.
Good stuff. Now, we have a couple of minutes left here, Russell, before we wrap things up for this time. Anything else now you'd like to mention from the book, let's say another declassified case that you can talk a little bit about?
Well, I can clarify something. When we were forecasting silver futures, and that's something we did a number of times successfully, you cannot do that by reading the numbers on the big board of the commodity exchange. I just want to remind people, you can't get analytical data. So we made use of something called associative remote viewing, where the broker would have each week four different objects corresponding to what we wanted to know. We wanted to know, is silver going to go up a little, up a lot, down a little, or down a lot? He would have four objects on his desk. And I would then ask my viewer, here we are Monday, tell me about the object I'll put on your desk next Friday. And that corresponded to what silver would do during the week. So the person would describe an object. He might say, the object you're going to hand me is kind of round and is kind of floppy and soft and has a weird smell that's actually kind of disgusting, round, floppy object. I would say that's a wonderful description, because as Ingo Swann says, this has the aesthetic impact of actually holding the object. So I would ask the broker. I'd call the broker and say, what are your objects this week? He said, well, if silver goes up a lot, I'd show you a champagne bottle. If it goes up a little, I'll show you a coffee cup. If it goes down a little, I'll show you a book. If it goes down a lot, I'll show you my leftover pancake from breakfast. I say, well, it looks like my viewer has described your pancake. And based on my viewer's description of the pancake, we would sell silver. We sell silver short into actually a rising market. So the viewer can't say sell silver or it's going down more than a quarter. But the viewer can describe is what I'm going to put in his hand next week. So then when silver does go down at the end of the week, the broker will deliver the leftover pancake. So indeed, the broker will deliver the leftover pancake to the viewer, so he does get to hold this rather disgusting floppy object he described a week earlier. So we call this associative remote viewing. And it's very important to realize you can't describe what the market's going to do. All you can describe is what you're going to hold in your hand at a later time.
Ah.
And we're able to do that quite successfully.
Very interesting. Yeah, indeed. Now, I want to give out the book title again here, of course, before we wrap things up. The Reality of ESP, A Physicist's Proof of Psychic Abilities. And as Russell said before, you can, of course, pick this up on Amazon.com or some of the main bookstores out there. And also we want to give out the website again, espresearch.com. This has been very interesting, Russell. I really appreciate you taking the time talking with us today, and I hope you do carry on the work. And are you looking into something else next, or what's up for your next here?
Well, my passion right now is to understand how we can know the future. So the physicist wants to understand causality. So if I discover that my dream last night corresponds to what I see on my computer screen in the morning from the New York Times, I have to assume something like the New York Times front page on Wednesday was the cause of my dream on Thursday. So I'm very interested in this retrocausality.
Huh. Interesting.
So that's what I'm pursuing now. Retrocausality is a new hot topic in modern physics, in addition to ESP.
Okay. How far do you think, Russell, that this could go? Are we talking about machines that are tapping into the future? Will mankind be able to predict the future at one stage?
Well, we are able to predict the future. I don't know if machines can predict the future, but human awareness is able to move into the future.
And do you think that this will become an accepted science, if you will?
Oh, I'm sure that it will. People are now doing experiments that work with much higher reliability. And as the reliability of ESP experiments gets better and better, then it will become obvious that we have these abilities to use. See, we, in the 1980s, we made $100,000 in the silver market. I belong to an organization called the International Remote Viewing Association, IRVA.org. And this comprises the Army officers that we taught to do remote viewing in the 80s and a lot of other people who are all interested in applied remote viewing. So people are using psychic abilities to forecast the stock market and sporting events. So there's a great interest in making use of psychic abilities for making money. And as soon as somebody makes $1 million in the stock market and talks about it, then it will resume great nationwide interest.
Yeah, exactly. Had to be something like that to spur it on, I guess. All right. Well, very good. Let's end on that note then. Thank you again for your time, Russell. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the opportunity to chat with you.
Thank you for listening and for staying with us here at RedIceMembers.com. We have some great programs coming up. Part 2 with Olle Damegård on the assassination of Olof Palme. We have Lynn Picknett on Lucifer Revised, and then Randall Carlson returns, and this time we're going to talk more about sacred geometry. Well, guys and gals, this is it for this time. Please stay with us for more. We'll be back in just a few days. My thanks to everyone at Red Eyes for their hard work. Fredrik, Lana, and Elizabeth. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and I hope you have a great rest of your day. What is remote viewing?
Would you like me to search the web for remote viewing?
What is ESP?
Looking. Okay, here you go.
What is psychic abilities?
Would you like me to search the web for psychic abilities?